This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
And perfect Dharma is ready met with even 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to, to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Well, it says here at the top of this page that this talk is on the topic of what is Zazen. And when I was putting the final touches on these notes the other day, I thought, what the hell am I doing? I can't talk about Zazen. Maybe you can talk around it. Besides, everyone probably has some notion by now of what Zazen is for them. At any rate, there will be no definitive answer at the end of this lecture. Because of the way my mind works, I tend to be, literal, mental, logical. I like things to make sense, and I like them to have I want to be able to explain things to myself. And that, I suppose, is one approach to the question, what is Zazen? I mean, you could look at the word literally and say, well, Za is sitting, Zen is the Japanese word for Chan, which is the Chinese word for Dhyana, Sanskrit word, meaning, according to our big fat Buddhist dictionary upstairs, meditative absorption. Well, in the half a page definition of Dhyana, it looked like there were maybe, I don't know, a dozen meditative absorptions. Seems like states within states, a very kind of Indian approach to things. And then, of course, at the end of the listing, it said, also see samadhi. Well, there's another half page on samadhi. So, even though my mind tends in that direction, it also, when it comes to something as, shall we say, elusive as Zazen, my mind just gives out after a while. It just gets, that is a not a fruitful line of inquiry. Nevertheless, we have to have some direction in which to orient ourselves, or we won't know what we're doing. The script is maybe not such a good idea. Anyways, we have to aim in some direction. But I think if we try and grasp hold of that thought or that concept too much, then we can kind of easily lose our way. A personal example of that, and I know several of you have heard this story already, it's one of my favorite stories, and I repeat it frequently because it had a lot of meaning to me at the time, and I still think about it on occasion. And that's when I was doing Tongariro at Tassajara, which, as you may know, 5 days of sitting from basically 4:30 in the morning till 9:30 at night. And it was very hot, and my knees were aching, and the little gnats were in my ears, my nose hanging around the corners of my mouth, my eyes. I was going crazy. And I guess it was in the break after that practice period, I was complaining to Islan about, oh, I had such a hard time in Tongaria, poor me. There were the gnats, there was the heat, there were my knees. And I kept trying to do zazen. And he says, that was your zazen. And that hit me like a thunderbolt. Prior to that, even though I'd been practicing for 2 or 3 years, I guess I must have had some very firm idea about what zazen was, like serene, calm, vast ocean, whatever. Anyways, that turned my view around just a little bit. So as I was saying, we do need some direction to go in, and Dogen gives very explicit directions in several places, but probably most so in the Fukan Zazengi, the rules for Zazen. He says, Zazen is not thinking of good, not thinking of bad. It is not conscious endeavor. It is not introspection. Do not desire to become a Buddha. Let sitting or lying down drop away. So Dogen and others as well repeatedly remind us that zazen has nothing whatsoever to do with sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. And he continues on in the Fukan Zazengi, sit solidly in samadhi and think not thinking. How do you think not thinking? Beyond thinking. This is the art of zazen. Zazen is not learning to do concentration. It is the Dharma gate of great ease and joy. So, you might wonder, how do you sit solidly in samadhi if zazen has nothing whatsoever to do with sitting, standing, so on and so forth? I'm rather tempted sometimes to say that actually it has everything to do with sitting, standing, lying down, walking. Also, eating, working, and all of our other daily activities. If, it's a pretty big if, in addition to thinking, not thinking, we sit, not sitting, eat, not eating, and work, not working. That, I guess, is as good a definition as I would have of samadhi. Maybe misusing that term, I'm not really sure, but that's kind of my take on samadhi, where this complete beyond thinking engagement with our everyday life is what it's all about. And zazen, speaking of samadhis, is called the king of samadhis. You can't do any better than that, I guess. So, if you'll excuse me for being a form queen, because that's what I am, I'd like to say a little bit about some of the other forms of Zen, because even though zazen is the king of samadhis and it is our primary practice, there are lots of other things we do. It seems to me that if you do things in a very specific way, like eating oryoki, or doing prostrations, or being doan, or any of the number of things that we do in a peculiar way around here, then what happens is, in that container we're creating, we can allow our awareness to expand in and fill that container and fill the posture of zazen. Completely fill them with the whole body and mind so that there's really no difference between ourselves and the activity, ourselves and others. We have a book in our library upstairs. It's a wonderful book that actually I saw the title for the longest time sitting there, and for some reason it just didn't interest me. It's called Zen Rituals. And there's a chapter in there that I particularly like by Taikin Dan Leighton called Zazen as Enactment Ritual, the Enactment of Awakening. And he says in there, the point is to exact the meaning, enact the meaning of the teachings in actualized practice. And the whole praxis, including meditation, may be viewed as ritual, ceremonial expressions of the teaching, rather than as a means to discover and attain some understanding of it. There's a very famous story that everyone knows by now, I'm sure, of Mazu and Nanyue. And Mazu is sitting zazen one day, and Nanyue, his teacher, comes along and says, "What are you doing?" Mazu says, "Sitting. What for?" "In order to become a Buddha." So Nanyue picks up a tile and starts polishing it. Mazu says, "What are you doing?" "Polishing a tile." "What for?" "To become a Buddha. I mean, to make a mirror." And Mazu says, "How can you make a mirror by polishing a tile?" And Nanyue says, "How can you become a Buddha by sitting zazen?" So the immediate understanding of that story, I think, is that you will never become a Buddha by sitting zazen. Don't even think about it. But when Dogen talks about this in the Shobogenzo, particularly in a fascicle called Old Mirror, he says, as usual, he tweaks things and turns them around on you so that your understanding that you start off with ends up being kind of flipped on you, or he gives you a different viewpoint or a different approach to the phrase. And he says that polishing a tile is making a mirror. Sitting is being a Buddha. So we sit and we be Buddha, and when we get up from that, we may forget that we're Buddha. So to help us out, we have these other forms that I mentioned before, like prostrations, chanting, eating orioki, soji, cleaning in the morning, that help us remember that we're Buddha and to expand the activity of being Buddha into our daily lives. Further on, Leighton says, we can see in all Zen rituals that at least ideally, ritual activity does have some impact or liberative effect for the participants. On the other hand, attachment to the more procedural forms of ritual is traditionally considered a hindrance to practice. So we do all these funny forms not to become a Buddha, not as a means to an end, gaining merit or whatever, but to meet each activity completely. When we're fully engaged in our life and practice, and I mean completely, intimately engaged, even if only for an instant. At that point, there is no notion of self and activity, self and other. This is the practice and realization of all Buddhas. Of course, you know, moments such as these where you have a feeling of being completely engaged in your activity, they're pretty rare. And I don't think that we need to be too concerned about whether we actually have those experiences or not. If they come, they do, and if they don't, they don't. But I think we just need to have continuous practice and have faith that whether or not a special occurrence or feeling arises, that just in our practice we are taking care of Buddha, and Buddha's taking care of us. There's another wonderful little source in our library that I like quite a bit. I read it quite a long time ago because initially when I was interested in food and cooking and so on, I read the Tenzo Kyokan, and I love the version where Uchiyama Roshi gives a commentary on it. And because of that, I kind of got to like Uchiyama Roshi quite a bit, and I read another book of his called Approach to Zen. And in that book, it's almost like he's talking to kindergartners, and I guess in some sense that's what we are when we first come to practice anyways. And he draws a little diagram in there, and there's this horizontal line, and that represents the posture of Zazen. And then there's like a sine wave that goes up and down below and above the line. And where the line goes above represents, oh, getting lost in daydreams and idle thoughts and distractions of various sorts. And then the part that goes below, the line represents nodding off or sleepiness, drowsiness, that sort of thing. And Uchiyama Roshi says that returning from the little sine wave on the top or the bottom of the horizontal line, returning to the horizontal line, that's what Zazen is. It's not the form of Zazen. It's certainly not sleeping wool gathering. It's returning. So I think we just continually return to the body and mind here and now. That's our practice as far as I see it. And that is the essence of Zazen. This willingness to turn from our distractions or whatever it may be. I mean, it could be anything. It could be, you know, anger, fear. It might even be a sense of ecstasy or something like that. If we just turn the light inward, then that's the most important point. Sometimes we have pain or it's some sort of situation in our lives that's uncomfortable. And I think if we can just turn at that point, in Uchiyama Roshi's demonstration, to me, that coming back, that turning, that is it's like a pivot in which your awareness turns. And I think, at least in my experience, that pivot, in addition to being becoming aware of your drowsiness, wandering mind, and so on, it can also be things like you notice that your mudra is collapsing, or you notice there's a knot in your back, or any number of things. Or it could be even a word or a phrase that comes to mind. And those, to me, are all pivots in which we can turn our awareness back to just this. Usually we don't want to do that. Usually when we have an unpleasant situation, we want to figure out a way to get out of it immediately. And that's kind of an automatic response. And I think it's helpful to if when you notice your reaction to the situation, if you can, even if it's just for a second, just stop and be with that situation, however uncomfortable it may be. And then, if action needs to be taken, such as adjusting your posture or running screaming from the room, whatever it may be, you know, then I guess you have to do that. But I think it's good if you can pause for a moment and just try and be with the situation at hand, whatever it may be, before you decide to act. This I left the third page of the notes upstairs in my room, so I'm gonna have to really wing it now.
David, do you want me to go grab it?
You might never find it in the mess.
Okay.
I'll do the best I can.
No, this is ideal.
So, as I was saying, this turning in this pivot of whatever it is that you may notice, and sometimes it's a word. A wonderful example came up in a book that I read not too long ago called The Cloud of Unknowing. It's a book by a Christian cleric in the 14th century in England, anonymous person. And he suggests in there using a word like God or love as a turning point. And I tried to find the quote for that and I couldn't find it, but I would highly recommend the little book. It's a wonderful demonstration of practice, I think, and including all the little pitfalls we may find along the way. And even though it's directed toward the Christian contemplatives, there is so much in there, I think, that can speak to any person that has undertaken this way of life to whatever degree. The complete title of this book is called A Book on Contemplation, called The Cloud of Unknowing, in which cloud a soul is united with God. Now, you know, I'm not a scholar of comparative religions or anything like that, but I just can't help but tweak that title a little bit. I want to translate it into Buddhistical terms. So the way I think of it is the cloud of unknowing in which the true self is united with things as it is. I wish I had my third page of notes. Anyways, that really kind of sums up practice for me, is if we can try and reside in the cloud of unknowing, and you may have heard something like that, don't know mind, or beginner's mind. I think essentially it's the same thing. If we can just be present in this cloud of unknowing, then the true self will unite with things as it is. And of course, the true self is already things that is as it is. But the only way we can meet that is if we can just reside in this cloud of unknowing. So I used a lot of words to try and dance around the subject of what is Zazen. And I hope I've conveyed something of my feeling for it. But when it comes right down to it, I think we just have to be in that cloud of unknowing and have don't know mind and see what happens next. So that's about all I have to say on the subject. And thank you all. Any questions or comments or anything? You can just do Zazen. Yes.
I have a comment. I do appreciate the ending that it is something that one just has to sit with. I find a huge conflict and contradiction between trying to explain an experience. When you talk about samadhi, it's about an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when you try to understand it, when you try to verbalize it, when you use words to explain it, you limit yourself to the words, the vocabulary, and the experience. But you know, it's really hard for me to express what I'm trying to say in that when you sit and you meditate or you try to achieve samadhi, it's an experience. How do you explain an experience? By explaining experience, you kind of modify the experience. You're telling someone what to experience. So it's really, to me, that's the ultimate conflict in trying to explain something to someone, given guidance of what this is about. But what it really is then is how do you explain or understand or grasp an experience?
Well, you can't really. It's just exactly as you said. You can't experience as experience. It's something that happens. And although the ruminations of the mind may be included in that experience, they don't touch completely on the experience itself. And I think that within ourselves, we don't really need to explain it to ourselves. We just need to experience it. But if you want to convey something to someone, you have to use words. And so you just do the best you can. And I mean, we have many great, you know, ancestors and teachers that have tried for several hundred thousands years for, you know, to do that exact same thing. So I frequently resort to the old guys, you know, and gals, to see what they had to say. And first, I find if this is a resonation between what, resonance between what they say and what I experience. And then, if that's the case, I could sort of plagiarize. I can use their words when I'm speaking with someone, like I just did in this lecture. I've quoted, you know, Taikin Dan Leiden, Dogen, and so on, because I felt that they did a better job than I could ever do with trying to get some idea across about what I was talking about, even though you can't, it's like I said at the beginning, you can't talk about Zazen. It's like samadhi, it's an experience. You can't really convey it, but if you want to help other people in some way, you have to use words, and so you just have to do the best you can, and sometimes you're gonna make a mistake, and well, yeah. Too bad, try again. Later. You know.
No, I think that's right. It just, for me, there's just this tension between trying to guide someone,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to tell someone what, you know, what it's all about, and but at the same time, changing what it really is, changing the essence of it, because your vocabulary and your experience is limited to your experience and your knowledge of the language. So a person's experience is something so vast, so complex, that it may not be confined to what the language can express.
No, no, it's not. Not at all.
Yeah. So I sense that as part of my own frustration, that, you know, how do you, and I, you know, it, what, trying to understand it, but maybe that the point is, you're right, it's just not you know, trying to understand something that shouldn't
it's
really
not,
be.
It's not understandable, in the terms of mental processes and so on, although using mental processes and so on to think about and study things in a certain way can be useful. We shouldn't discard the use of language simply because it's inadequate. Yeah. Oh, Jonathan Burton.
I was just thinking also in terms of that, that sometimes that religious art can sometimes get closer or in a different way can echo those experiences, or maybe there's some kind of recognition of experience that's reflected in various kinds of religious art.
I suppose, I mean, you definitely, when you walk into Chartres, for instance, and you see these stained glass windows and these, you know, weeping virgins and whatnot, it's really quite marvelous. And you do have, even I'm not even a Christian, right? And I walk in there someplace like that and I have a feeling. But I think there may be a fine line, or maybe it's even not so fine, between this sort of warm, cozy feeling, maybe it's even a little sentimental or whatever, between that and the ineffable. And with the ineffable, there's just, I mean, yes, like you say, that maybe, you know, trying to manifest it or embody it in some way through a statue or painting or a religious architecture or something like that, it can definitely, I think, assist us to move in that direction. But I'm not sure. I think even it falls short.
I think so too. But I think it's like an echo or a hint or a glimmer, or there's going to be some recognition or reminder.
Yeah. Well, particularly, I think if religious art truly comes out of the heart of the person that's making it, then something of that gets conveyed, I think.
Yeah. Wouldn't you say that the attempt to convey is an important lesson for yourself, and that it's really a gift to you to have the opportunity to try to express it to others?
Yeah, I do think, in my case, I don't know if it's a gift. It's, this is really, public speaking is not my thing, you know. I'm always
not like a gift, like a pretty dress, but you know.
Yeah, I know. but I, you know, I have found a different kind of relationship with words now than I had before, and it actually started when we were studying the Book of Serenity. Mm. I started to get, even though studying that stuff is like pulling teeth. I mean, it's just all those Chinese names, and oh my God, give me a break, you know? And yet, if you can somehow peel away at least that outer layer of the onion and get into it a little bit, those words they're very useful. Mm-hmm. They're not really conveying something to us that we can grasp, but they're showing us, like Dogen is a perfect example of taking a phrase or a word and then turning it a little bit so that you think you've got it, but he pulls a rug out from under you, and there you are floating in the void again. You know? So I think words are useful to use, and yes, they are a gift. I mean, it's what separates us from the apes, right? That and an opposable thumb, where would we be without them? So it is really integral to who we are. We can't, you know, we can't just sit there blissed out in in this cloud of unknowing without there being something to orient us.
Yeah, although I've just found it a really difficult but really useful practice to try to explain it to other people, and sometimes it seems to help them. And recently I had a situation where I talked for a long time about Zazen, and then the friend I was with said, okay, now I think I feel worse And I thought, part of me thought, well, that's your problem. But then part of me, you know, whatever.
Well,
but
I think
but it was good for me to at least try to talk about it.
Yeah, it is good. But it also depends, I think, on the receptivity of your audience.
Sure.
Like if there's some people, let's say they're maybe karmically ripe to receive some information, then they would be a more ready audience for whatever it is that you might be explaining to them.
Yeah,
whereas other people would be, they're just asking you because it's an idle question. So you know, there's a little difference. So you have to, I think you have to gauge the people you're speaking to as best you can to know how to speak to them and what kind of words to use.
Right.
Jim?
Shiseo, thank you for your talk. One of the concepts that I've struggled with and I hear and different thinking about it is everything is Zazen. And I wondered if you alluded a little bit to that in your talk, and I wondered if you could maybe give us some clarity.
Well, I was trying to do more than allude. I was almost trying to hit you over the head with it. Because in my experience, if you give the same sort of broad awareness to every detail of your life, handling a teacup, washing dishes, cleaning house, whatever, typing at the computer, reading, going out having a drink with friends, you name it. If you can give the same kind of broad awareness to all of those instances, then can you really find the difference between Zazen and daily activity? I mean, I think it becomes increasingly more difficult as time goes by. If you completely and always returning to practice, and just this moment, whatever it may be. And I think that's why we use all these strange forms, because they help us to, they kind of sort of paint a stripe on the road for us to kind of follow down, because, you know, if you just go about your day of life, it's easy to go la-di-da-da-da, you know, whatever. And we aren't really able to sort of gather ourselves together in, you know, the moment and meet it directly when we have that state of mind. So these forms kind of help us to sort of channel a little bit. So in that book, Zazen as an Act of Ritual, he goes on at great length to talk about how the forms are useful in that instance. So is that?
Thank you. Something that is hit me and resonated in your talk is, two things. One was this idea of not knowing, and that in my experience, what I gathered here from others is that not knowing for us often tends to fill us with fear, anxiety, you know, what's going to happen in the future, I don't know about this, I don't know about that. And so what I found for myself in Zazen is that when I hear of dropping away, this knowing is kind of what everyone here was saying, is you're just in this experience, one with the activity. And so it's not a knowing of dialectical dissecting the experience and, oh, this is how you scientifically, you know, make a cake. It's like you are one with making a cake. You're just in there with the batter and the egg, and totally. So it's, and the second thing that resonated, still has hit me, this phrase that you said of taking care of the Buddha. And that sort of was a good, it just fell of how in taking care in terms of that enactment part, we're very caring about our practice or with each other and kind of continuing to extend that outside of here. If I can be taking care of the Buddha and all that I meet and with myself in this moment and working, you think it's just like, oh, okay, that can somehow begin to ease some of that not knowing. Mm-hmm. I can just take care to sit. Mm-hmm. I can just take care to be, you know, just do type at my computer. I can mm-hmm. take care. That taking care of the Buddha really, I don't know, it's just resonating, that phrase.
My first lecture last Monday, I was recounting my first practice period here at Hartford Street, and when I got up from the first period of Zazen on the first day of Zazen to end the retreat, my back went out. And so I was basically crippled in bed for 5 days. And I came down for the Shuso ceremony at the end of the practice period. And I asked the Shuso, I said, what is the difference between this body and Buddha's body? Because to me, there was this chasm between the two, right? And he said, take good care of it. And so that's a really good example, I think, of we don't have to think about the Buddha's here and we're here, because there's maybe not so much difference, you know? If we just take care of it all, it's like you said, I think we just take care of each moment, then even though we may have fear and anxiety about something, if you can just sort of take the next step or do whatever presents itself as, you know, the next thing to do, because there is fear and anxiety in the unknown, but there's also limitless possibility right in front of you, right the next thing. You don't know what's going to happen, so it's an opportunity to sort of dive in and to see what's going to happen and try to take care of it.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right, well, you can let me know if these sort of things are buoyant. Sometimes I like hearing these sort of things on a resonance level. Like I was thinking about those things this morning about, isn't it funny how we use words to talk about something that's beyond words, and why is it, you know? And I guess I thought of the Book of Serenity case too, you know, the one where Miao probably remembers this better. There's the set up one speck of dust, and the nation flourishes. But if you don't set up a speck of dust, the nation perishes. But if you set up that little speck of dust, all the elders and everybody was, oh, too much, saying too much, sort of, but I appreciate your, you know, coming in and using words with us. I was curious about the pivot sort of thing, like mm-hmm. you talked about. I find sometimes I really have to do that, like the train is so, like, but I have to actively pivot there while sitting, whereas sometimes it feels like kind of like the body is here and there's this sort of like almost pulling out. I mean, I don't want to say like, oh, it's like a spirit or something, but this sort of like, I think of the backward step sort of thing, and sort of allowing what was there to be there without having that sense of just complete, you know, complete absorption that's lacking any sort of awareness about what that is. That ability, well, that sense of no longer necessarily identifying as myself with what that train of thought was before.
The train of thought that's kind of leading
you
away. I think when we become aware of these, you know, distractions or whatever they may be, and maybe it's some feeling or whatever, that that sort of turning, it's not an abrupt thing. It's not like, oh, I was doing bad, now I need to do good. You know, it's more subtle and gentle than that. It's just like, okay, I see this is what's going on. And no, I don't mean that in so many words, because then that can become another trip you're going off on, you know, and just sort of a quiet awareness of this is what's happening, and then just turn just a little bit in that the pivot, as I call it, of whatever, your collapsed mudra, your wandering thought, whatever, and just bring that line of awareness back to body and mind right here and now. Well, I think the schedule says it's time for Mojalin, if you're interested.
All of my birthday party.
I can't hear you very well.
All of my birthday party.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah. So isn't that a good excuse to settle on ourselves in when you have to get that cake afterwards? Not that it's a reward or anything. And it's its own reward. Okay, thank you all very much.
May our intention equally extend to every being.